Chapter 72. Lake Marie, New Hampshire. It's 2 a.m. in Montana when I make my third call. As the phone rings and rings, I wonder just who's going to finally answer this landline to an isolated farmhouse near the Beartooth Mountains owned by Trask Floyd, movie director and action star and former operator who supplied me with transportation to D.C. those long days ago. The phone rings for a long while, and then a sleepy male voice answers and says slowly and with distinction, "If you're some starlet convinced that you belong in my next movie because you can giggle on cue, go away. And if you're a former operator looking for a handout, send your resume to my P.O. box. Other than that, you call again, I'm going to chase you down and kick your ass." I say, "How about the former leader of the free world?" A quick expletive and the wide-awake voice now says, "Mr. President, Jesus, I'm sorry. I didn't recognize the number." I say, "That's for a reason, Trask. I'm using a burner phone and I'm calling on your landline. And please, it's Matt." A yawn from the other end of the call. "Sorry, Matt, just instant reaction. And damn, I'm still so sorry about Mel. Good Lord. Appreciate it, Trask. How did you know I'd be home?" "Saw a Google News story about you attending a film festival in Boise," I say. "I figured you'd probably bunk down after a romp like that." He starts to talk and then stops himself and says, "Burner phone, huh?" "Yes. What do you need?" Good old Trask, getting right to the point. I say, "Two skilled operators you know and trust. They have to be recently retired or on extended leave. They need to be quickly available and be able to drop out of sight for a while with no questions being asked." Trask says, "Make it one. I'll be the second." Trask, "Great offer, but Matt," he interrupts, "I'm in as good shape as I was when I left the teams. I hit the range almost every day, and with me, you've got funds and options." I say, "But I also have Trask Floyd, actor and movie director, extremely recognizable, with lots of weird fans following your every move." "And you," he says incredulously, "the former president?" "The former president wearing ratty clothes, sunglasses, beard stubble, and a baseball cap," I say. "Just another guy out there in a car or catching a flight. Ex-presidents are recognizable when they're dressed well, surrounded by a group of Secret Service agents, making a speech or appearing on a cable news show. That's not what I'm going to do." He says, "Then we should make it three. Matt, I want in. You get me two operators and some additional funds and support when I need it, then you'll be in, Trask. Don't make this any harder." A sigh. "Okay, you got it. Two operators. Where should I send them?" "I'll call you at noon your time in 2 days. That work?" "It'll have to now, won't it?" "Thanks," Trask says. "Okay. And if I'm not going to be riding shotgun with you on wherever you're going, I'll still be behind you. And if you come back with that son of a bitch's head in a box filled with ice, we'll have a celebration at my ranch that they'll talk about for 100 years. You'll be safe, Mr. President." "Thanks, Trask," I say, disconnecting the call. I pry open the rear of the Trask phone, remove the battery and the SIM card, and then snap the SIM card in two. I get out of my chair, and a few minutes later, I'm at the end of the dock. Quiet, late night on Lake Marie. The clouds have cleared the northern New Hampshire night sky. I take a moment to appreciate all those stars and all those billions of galaxies out there. Some nights, a sight like this fills me with awe to think of a creator who put this all together. Other nights, it fills me with despair. To think of that grandeur out there, and yet on this little speck of dust, so much time is spent hating and killing. I toss the broken SIM card and phone into the dark waters of the lake and stop looking at the stars. I reach into my pants pocket and touch Mel's ring, the one she left behind when she was kidnapped, and which was later returned to us by the FBI. "I see him," I whisper. "I'm coming for you."
Chapter 73. Lake Marie, New Hampshire. Secret Service agent David Stahl is outside the garage at President Matt Keating's home, near Harbor's workout shed, ready to go into town to run a few errands this early evening, when a high-pitched male voice calls out,
"Hey, David, before you leave, got a sec?"
Coming toward him with a big fake smile and happy eyes is fellow Secret Service agent Brett Payton, and David keeps himself from sighing in disgust at the man's approach. Peyton looks like some Homeland Security hiring officer's dream agent. Tall and well-built, tanned and toned, perfect brown hair that's never messed up, and with a charming way about him. He's also a favorite agent of Faith Murray, deputy assistant director in charge of the Presidential Protection Detail. She's David's boss, and the woman who told him months ago to stop providing unofficial protection for Mel Keating. And in addition, for long weeks now, David has been pushing to have a deputy special agent in charge to assist him, and Brett has been named to that position.
"Sure, Brett," David says. "What's up? Going into town?"
"No, you damn fool," David thinks. "I'm taking a drive to Cape Cod."
"Sure seems that way," he says. "Can I get you anything? Some Green Mountain coffee, a cruller, bottle of Moxie?"
No,
Peyton gently protests.
"I just think it's odd, that's all. You're in charge of this protective detail, and yet here you are doing something that a rookie agent should be assigned to do."
"I like to get out on occasion, see what's going on in the community, get a feel of the place."
"That's in your official procedures, then?"
Peyton asks. And David is reminded once again why Peyton is really here. Not to assist in protecting Harbor or to help David as his deputy, but to gather information and intelligence on David and the detail, so they can be publicly and loudly humiliated and fired at the appropriate time for letting the president's daughter get kidnapped and murdered.
"No, Brett," David says, tapping the side of his head. "It's part of my field experience. You should try it someday."
Peyton keeps on smiling, and David climbs into one of the four black Chevrolet Suburbans belonging to the detail and heads off to Monmouth. The access road is dirt, but well-maintained, and as he drives, he thinks about Harbor and what he wants. David is surprised at how thinking about this improbable mission has improved his mood, has charged up his batteries. There's no way in hell it's going to succeed, he knows, not with so much attention out there, keeping track of Harbor, but by God, he and Harbor and whoever else Harbor recruits are going to give it their best. Up ahead is a new wooden gatehouse, staffed by two of the new agents transferred here, and they wave him through, and he turns right, heading into the small village of Monmouth. He comes up against a roadblock maintained by well-armed troopers from the New Hampshire State Police, and they let him through as well. He spots the black bands around their badges, still mourning the death of Monmouth officer Corinne Bradford, who did so much to locate Mel Keating's place of captivity. He notes with pleasure the reduced number of people crowding each side of the country road, ghouls looking for some sign of a sad and lonely Harbor. For more than 2 weeks, the town of Monmouth has been under siege from the news media and assorted losers, psychics, and attention seekers, and David wishes a winter blizzard would suddenly descend here, months ahead of schedule, to drive these people back to their sorry homes.
Rodney Pace walks back and forth, in the crowded dirt parking lot of Cook's General Store, waiting, knowing that if he doesn't see Matt Keating today, then it will mean another night of sleeping in the back seat of his old Monte Carlo sedan, and he's not sure his back can survive that. 3 days ago, he made a momentous decision to drive up here from his crappy and cluttered studio apartment in Baltimore to personally meet the former president and explain what's really going on. But his attempts to approach Keating's lakefront home haven't even come close to succeeding. Too many roadblocks, too many police, and most of all, too many people. In researching this rural place, Rodney learned that Monmouth is supposed to have a population of only 600 or so, but in looking around the parking lot, he thinks it sure seems as though the town's population has doubled in size. In the dirt parking lot are news vans from various cable channels and local stations, rental vans and cars, and people just wandering around with coffee cups, chatting and gossiping, all waiting. Not waiting for the search and rescue to end. No, those words have changed. It's now a recovery. The body of Mel Keating. As if. The store looks like a rehabbed two-story Victorian-style yellow house with a wide-open wooden front porch. Hand-drawn signs outside announce church-sponsored Sunday pancake breakfasts, hay for sale by farmers, raffles to help pay for someone's kidney transplant. Inside, along the creaky wood floors that must be at least 100 years old, boxes of cereal are for sale, one aisle away from motor oil and another aisle away from nail clippers and brushes for horses. Rodney's stomach grumbles. His plan was to see the president, be rewarded for his efforts. But he is out of money, with less than a dollar in change in his right jacket pocket. What now? A black Chevrolet Suburban pulls up across the narrow road, and a muscular man steps out, and Rodney stops walking back and forth, back and forth, awed by what he's seeing. Secret Service agent. That's who that man is. Right over there. Now all he needs to do is convince the Secret Service agent to take him to see President Keating. Rodney starts walking to meet up with him and puts his hand in his thin cloth jacket's right pocket, grasping the butt of the Smith & Wesson 38 caliber revolver that belonged to his dad years ago when he was a cop in Baltimore. One way or another, Rodney is going to see President Keating.
Chapter 74. Monmouth, New Hampshire. Secret Service agent David Stahl gets out of the Suburban, starts walking across the narrow country road toward Cook's General Store, shaking his head upon seeing the circus over there. 3 weeks ago, he could have parked right in front of the store, maybe with two or three cars and a mud-splattered pickup truck or two in the gravel lot. And now, there's no space for any other vehicles. The store's interior is always crowded as well, and instead of spending a fun few minutes chatting with Mrs. Grissom, the store's owner, or her two sons, Clay and Todd, now David just goes in, does his business, and heads back to the compound. Today's business is getting some coffee for the evening shift, as well as a few other odds and ends, and David hopes he can get out without some journalist recognizing him and asking questions, starting with, "How did you let the president's daughter get kidnapped and murdered?" The porch and the parking lot are filled with those damn reporters, hangers-on, mourners, and thrill-seekers hoping to see Harbor make an appearance, or, more exciting, to see a dark green van from the New Hampshire Medical Examiner's Office drive by, escorted by New Hampshire State Police cruisers, carrying the mortal remains of Mel Keating, age 19. To hell with them all. David changes his earlier wish for an off-season blizzard to strike these fools, and instead is wishing for Old Testament fire and brimstone to strike, when he spots somebody coming at him who looks like an Old Testament prophet. Skinny, baggy jeans, torn tan jacket, scraggly beard, and thick greasy hair, one eye swollen, driven look on his face, and David thinks, great, another one. There are Secret Service groupies, hangers-on, who want to pass on news about UFO landing sites or alien lizard-occupied office buildings, and this one's right jacket pocket is weighted with something heavy, like a weapon. The man puts his hand into the pocket and says, Agent Stahl, I need to see the president right away. The hand starts to come out, holding something, and David instantly responds.
My God, how fast and mean that agent is, his hand going to his side, whipping out a baton that instantly expands, and the baton is cracked against Rodney's hand, sending a bolt of pain through his entire right arm and shoulder. Rodney yelps and drops the revolver, and the baton swings again, hitting him at the back of the knees, and he tumbles to the ground. Strong hands are poking and patting and prodding, and there's a snap click as handcuffs are slapped around his wrists, and Rodney can't help it. He starts to sob, thinking, failed again. The agent is speaking into a radio, it seems. Rodney hears something like, requesting a pickup at Cook's General Store, one in custody, and then he's rolled over onto his back. The Secret Service agent is glaring at him in anger, reminding Rodney of his university's president staring at him with disgust throughout that damned hearing last year. Agent Stahl says,
"Who are you and what are you doing here?"
There's gravel and dirt in Rodney's mouth, and he spits it out and says, Agent Stahl, it's me. Don't you recognize me? The agent is standing over him and then leans down some.
No, I don't think so.
Rodney says, it's me, Rodney Pace, from the University of Baltimore. When I was a professor there, I taught some seminars at your Rowley Training Center. You were in two of my seminars, I'm sure. Agent Stahl squats, looking closer. A ring of people starts to gather around, and Stahl says,
Professor Pace, it's really you? Forensic sciences?
Sweet relief flows through Rodney. Maybe this will work out after all.
Yes, yes, that's me, he says.
What the hell are you doing here?
I need to see the president, desperately so, Rodney says. I have vital information for him.
What kind of information?
Rodney tells him, and Agent Stahl's angry face instantly changes, and he grabs Rodney's upper arm, pulls him to his feet, and then starts briskly walking him across the street to the Suburban. Just before they reach the parked vehicle, Stahl says,
Hold on a sec.
Rodney's wrists ache with relief when the handcuffs are removed, and Stahl quickly calls someone on his radio, speaking into his wrist microphone.
This is Stahl. Cancel my pickup request.
And then Rodney is put into the rear seat of the Suburban, and before he can even fasten his seatbelt, Stahl is in the driver's seat, roaring the engine to life, and the Suburban makes a sharp U-turn, tires squealing, and heads away from the store.
Chapter 75, Lake Marie, New Hampshire. I'm on the porch of my lakeside house, legal pad in my lap, lots of scribbled notes recording my day's work. It's now evening, and I'm sure close to dinner time, but I'm not that hungry. I don't think I've been hungry in 3 weeks. The lights are on, and various insects are battling and thumping against the porch screens. These past few hours, I've been sketching out an operations plan and setting aside the fact that I have no official support, no operators as of yet, no transportation assets, no tactical equipment or stores, and definitely no actionable intelligence. It's been one hell of a productive afternoon. The door squeaks open and Agent David Stahl steps in. I look hard in his direction and he gives me a quick, mournful shake of the head. I don't have to ask him anything. He's just answered me. Mel's body has still not been recovered. But it seems it's his turn to ask a question. Sir, will you come with me for a moment, he asks. Can it wait, I ask. Surprise. No, Mr. President, it can't, he says. I need to show you something in the furnace room. I get up, keep my pad and pen with me. I usually trust my detail, but I don't really know the new agents yet, and follow David through the large and darkened living room, down a hallway leading to a bathroom and well-stocked pantry, and to a door which David opens for me. We clomp down the wooden stairs, the lights already on, and emerge onto the dirt floor in this part of the basement. Lots of older homes up here still have dirt cellars, and I remember gently teasing Samantha that if she ever got tired of digging outdoors, she could start here and find out if there's anything interesting in our basement. Like a hidden Indian burial ground, I said. That'll explain the weird creaks at night. And she shot back, smiling. That still won't explain the weird creak I share a bed with. A happy lifetime ago, it seems. Up ahead is the confusing mass of pipes, vents, and wires, and the furnace and the dark fuel tank. Earlier, slabs of concrete were placed over the dirt. A workbench filled with tools is on the far side of the stone foundation wall, and an odd-looking man is sitting on a metal stool next to the bench. On the bench is a large open laptop, its screen blank. Mr. President, David says, this is Professor Rodney Pace, used to be head of the Forensic Sciences Department at the University of Baltimore. The man smiles, nods. His thick, dark hair is a greasy mess, and he's wearing dirty jeans and a tan cloth jacket that's torn and repaired with duct tape. He leans forward, offers a hand, which I automatically shake. The skin is cold and dry. Mr. President, a true honor, and I have to admit that I'm a former department head and, alas, a former professor. He sits back on the stool, shrugs, and says, an unfortunate event involving a number of my students and a camping trip and certain illegal substances. Well, a sordid story, not enough time to discuss what happened to me and my career, but here I am, I look in disbelief at David, and he says, "Sir, believe me, Professor Pace knows his forensics. Before he was forced to leave the university, he even lectured a few times at our Rowley Training Center in Maryland. He's the best in his field, knows his stuff, and he wants to show you something." I look at the blank screen of the open laptop, and I know what's hidden in there, in long strings of computer code of ones and zeros. My daughter's last moment broken down into something that could be saved forever. "I don't want to see it," David says. "I know, Mr. President. Believe me, I know. But please, listen to what Professor Pace has to say." "And what's that?" I ask sharply. David says, "Sir, trust me on this. You have to see it cold. No preconceptions." My legal pad feels useless and silly in my hands. I'm a former president, former SEAL, and former father. Not much of a legacy. "Go ahead," I say. My visitor hops off the stool and goes to the keyboard. It would have been best if I had the source video, could reduce the amount of pixelation and degradation for my examination, but we do what we can. Pay close attention now. He taps a few keys. A sound comes out, the anguished, "Mommy, don't!" And Rodney punches a key, and the audio goes silent, and there, in all their color and gore and excess, are the last few seconds of my daughter's life. And I don't look away. Won't look away. In the teams and when I was president, I saw enough grainy and bloody death videos to last several lifetimes. But this video is the only one that has woken me up in the middle of the night, shouting and with fists clenched in despair. "Did you see it?" the former professor asks. "Did you?" I choke out the words, "Yes, I did." Pace sighs like I'm a student who will struggle to earn even a D in his class. "I don't think you did. The last few seconds. Pay attention." The last few seconds. A burst of blood hitting the camera lens. A gloved finger smearing it. The shape on the rocks. The frizzy hair. And alone again. The eyeglasses. "There," the professor says with satisfaction in his voice. "Did you see it? Did you?" "See what?" I ask, frustration and anger and sadness all roiling inside of me. "What am I supposed to see?" He tisk-tisks, replays the video again, slowing it down, way down, from the sword descending. "Oh, Mel." The flicker, the blood spurting out and splashing the lens. "There," he says again, his voice filled with the impatience of some Cassandra, trying to share what he knows with the oblivious masses next to him who are ignoring God's word. Agent Stahl plays intermediary. "Professor, please, it's been a long couple of weeks. President Keating has been under tremendous pressure. Can you explain simply what we should be noticing?" "Ah, of course," he says. "My apologies. You see, when blood emerges from a fresh wound and strikes an object like the camera lens here, you get a type of blood pattern and spatter, and it's observable in a certain way. But when the blood doesn't come instantly from its source, then it looks and acts entirely different. That's what I saw here, and that's why I was so insistent on seeing you, Mr. President." Deep, deep inside of me, a little flare of something has just been ignited. "Oh, God," I think. "Please make it so. Please." I say, "Professor, are you saying what I think you're saying?" A confident nod. "The beheading video is a fake," he says. Chapter 76, Lake Marie, New Hampshire. I'm standing so close to the disgraced professor that I can smell his clothes and his sweat, and I don't care. I say, "Explain it again, slowly, with details I can understand, please, professor." And I think, if you're crazy or bullshitting me in any way, there's a shovel in the corner and a dirt basement floor behind me. "Certainly," he says. "It's a study that I came up with a few years back with assistance from a couple of my more intelligent grad students. It used to be that forensic investigators were just looking at the blood pattern, what's now known as spatter. You can examine a pattern at a crime scene, and most times you can deduce where the victim was standing or sitting or if he or she resisted and how the body was later transported. It's all there if you know how to read the spatter." He taps the side of his forehead and smiles. His teeth are yellow. The professor says, "I took it to another level by introducing the concept of fluid dynamics. When a fluid like blood is expelled, it makes a world of difference if the blood is fresh or stored. They act like two completely different sets of fluids. The consistency, the levels of oxygenation, all that comes into play. You can then determine if the blood spatter was part of the actual crime or an afterthought to set up a crime scene that has a false message. I wrote two papers on this for the journal Forensic Science International that received very positive responses from my colleagues. He taps again, this time on the screen. This is not fresh blood. In fact, if I had a better version of this video recording, I could make a strong case that it's not even human blood. The little flare of hope inside me is growing hard and fast, threatening to overtake my common sense and skepticism. But the earlier part of the video essay, the sword and the beheading, couldn't that be real? He shakes his head, sits back on the stool, crosses his arms. For what purpose? A real beheading followed by a fake blood spurt? What would be the point? Besides, before I was forced to leave the university, there were already studies underway because of the concern over what's known as deep fake videos. Taking a real video recording of President Barnes, for example, and changing her business suit into latex and feathers like a Las Vegas showgirl to make it look like she was taking part in some naughty Vegas review. Anyone with experience in filmmaking or special effects could probably come up with a way to take a real video of your daughter and then splice in a beheading scene. Agent Stahl starts to say something, and I snap, "No, not now. Everybody just shut up. Just don't say a word." I close my eyes, trying hard to remember. When I was president, each minute, half hour, and hour was scheduled down to the second, every day, even the weekends, with meetings, briefings, and reports, being asked to make decisions and judgments in areas from the economy to human rights to diplomacy to domestic issues and politics. A week into my presidency, not long after the funeral of my predecessor, I had a childhood memory. I remembered reading a paperback novel with its cover torn off that had been one of the few possessions of my father's that came back from the oil rig after his death. The book, called The Multiple Man, was published in 1976, and it took place sometime in an imagined future when the world was so deadly and complex that the elected president had six secretly cloned brothers, each one an expert in one field. Working together, each was able to bring his own special expertise to their collective administration during a very challenging era. It seemed fantastic and off the wall at the time, but later, in trying to remember all the details from that constant treadmill of meetings and briefings when I was in the Oval Office, it all made intriguing sense. Some science fiction future on the page or on the screen. I open my eyes. Faraj al-Rashid, I say. Asim's younger cousin. I received a number of intelligence briefings on him as well during the run-up to that raid. Before he joined jihad with Asim, he was in Paris, attending film school with an emphasis on fantasy, science fiction, and special effects. I reach for the keyboard, pull my hand away. I have this desperate desire not to spoil anything. Trying to keep the growing excitement out of my voice, I say, "Professor, please, run the video back to the beginning." "Certainly," he says. He gets off the stool, plays with the keyboard. The video speeds up in reverse. "Fake, fake, fake," I want to scream out. "My daughter's death was faked." And then he plays it from the beginning. The same stern-looking Asim al-Rashid is now there again. And from the computer's speakers comes his voice. After the initial greetings, he goes on.
"I apologize that this is not a, what you call a live feed, but a recording from several hours ago, after we departed the home of Mr. Macomber in your White Mountains. And here we are, in these mountains still."
"There," I say, "run it back to the very beginning, before he appears." Seconds later, the video starts up again and I say, "Freeze it right there." The professor is on my left and Agent Stahl is on my right. I gently trace the screen before me, which shows a rock wall and an adjoining ledge. With a soft voice, I say, "He says this is being recorded in the White Mountains. But look at that rock formation. In every hike I've done here with Sam Rimmel, there's always vegetation, from lichen to grasses to scrub brush among the rock formations. None of that is here. Can we be sure he filmed this here, in New Hampshire, or someplace else?" Agent Stahl says, "Mr. President, that's a hell of a good point." I strike the screen with some force, making it vibrate. We're going to find that out right now. And I think of last night, being on the dock out there in the darkness and vowing, Asim, I'm coming for you. Now, can I dare believe one more thing? Mel, I'm coming for you too.
Chapter 77. Enfield, New Hampshire. Trent Youngblood, associate professor of earth sciences at Dartmouth College, is drying off the last of his dinner dishes when there's a pounding at his front door, followed by the frantic ringing of the doorbell. He takes a look at the small Bavarian cuckoo clock hanging in the cluttered kitchen, a souvenir his wife Carol bought on a river cruise they took in Germany last year. The clock looks old and hand-carved, but it's a silly piece of kitsch made in Cambodia and operated by a hidden battery. Trent thinks the ridiculous thing is a good metaphor for his work, something that looks one way on the surface, but is revealed to be quite different once you start digging. The clock says it's almost 9 p.m. Who the hell could be banging on his door at this hour? Carol is off at a late-night Tai Chi class, and their son Greg is in California, attending the Stanford Graduate School of Business. The nearest neighbor is almost a half mile away. Instead of quickly answering the door, Trent checks his laptop on the kitchen counter, next to piles of mail, and sees the feed from the Nest Hello doorbell camera. What's there disturbs him. Three figures wearing jackets and caps pulled down low. The one in the lead hammers the door again, and Trent sees it's a black woman. Trent is so not a racist, but what's a black woman doing out here at this hour, in this part of rural New Hampshire? And what should he do? Call the police? Right, he thinks. Imagine what would happen to him and his career if that bit of news got out. A white, privileged college professor calling the police on a black woman knocking on his door at night. For all he knows, this trio could be lost and looking for directions. But then again, who gets lost nowadays with everyone having a GPS-enabled cell phone? The doorbell rings again. To hell with it. He'll answer the door. As he goes down the front hallway, he stops for a moment, opens a closet door, and takes down a loaded Colt 357 revolver from the top shelf. He's been to dig sites in some sketchy parts of the world, and just over 20 years ago, two Dartmouth professors were murdered in their homes by two local teenage losers. Trent isn't going to be a victim tonight. He switches on the outdoor light, gun partially hidden by his hip, unlocks the door, opens it, and says, "Can I help you?" And then the black woman yells, "Gun, gun, gun!" And he's slammed to the floor of his own home. He's brought to his feet, shaking with fear and anger, after being stripped of his revolver, and the black woman and another man are standing next to him, and the third man comes in, saying in a familiar voice,
"Professor Youngblood, I'm so sorry for that, but Agent Washington and Agent Stahl are true professionals. I hope you're not hurt."
The man removes his plain dark blue baseball cap, revealing the face of former President Matthew Keating. Trent blinks his eyes. It's no big deal having him live in the area. Hell, he's spotted Keating twice over the years at the local Whole Foods, but what's he doing here? Well, how can I help you? The former president's face is drawn, worn, and his eyes seem sunken, and Trent suddenly feels a deep sorrow for this man, whose daughter was publicly executed just 2 weeks ago. Keating says,
"I need your help. We've done some research and found out you're one of the best geology experts at Dartmouth. I need for you to look at a rock display for us. Tell me what you see. Can you do that?"
Holy crap, Trent thinks. He and his wife Carol spent countless hours 2 years ago working as volunteers to elect this man's vice president to the Oval Office, making phone calls, knocking on doors, and holding signs during the New Hampshire primary. There were political meetings at their house, with late-night drinks of wine and beer and determined vows to get that damn killer out of the White House. There were jokes about his Texas accent and his oh-so-smart and precious wife. Lots of snarky comments about his accidental presidency. They passed out bumper stickers saying, "Defeat Keating, the error of the era." Now, the error of the era is standing right in front of him. What would Carol think? What would their friends think? Trent nods. "Absolutely, Mr. President. I can start whenever you're ready." Minutes later, they're in Trent's crowded upstairs office, with workbench, shelves of books and binders, computer and filing cabinets, and shelves of rock samples from sites all over the world. The female Secret Service agent gets to work, and Trent is a bit miffed that she didn't apologize for tossing him violently to the floor. She opens a laptop she carried in, and in a few seconds, an image comes up. Rock wall, rock ledge. He's seen that before. "Oh, God," he thinks. "The place where this sad man's daughter was murdered." In a slightly strained voice, Keating says,
"Professor, give that rock face a good look. I know it's not a great image, but can you tell us? Is that from somewhere in the White Mountains?"
Trent bends over, gives the image a long, hard stare, and says, "Absolutely not." Keating's hand is on his shoulder.
"Are you sure? What are you seeing?"
Trent feels a bit of childish pride, explaining his work to a former president of the United States. He says, "If it was somewhere in New Hampshire, or even Vermont or Maine, that rock surface would be leucocratic, likely with cross-cutting quartz veins, and present surface fracturing, which is typical of the freeze and thaw weathering in granitoid rock you get in this part of the world. But you can see that rock surface is brown and shows the distinct bedding of a sedimentary rock, but there's a lack of distinct clastic grains, which means this rock is likely a limestone or dolostone." Keating's hand slightly tightens on Trent's shoulder.
"Can you tell us where it is?"
Trent says, "No, I can't." There's a sense of disappointment from his three visitors, and he quickly says, "No, no, don't worry. I can't. But my grandfather can. Hold on. Give me a few minutes." Trent goes to the binders in one section of his crowded shelves, finds the marker he's looking for, and hauls the old black file down. The former president and his Secret Service agents gather around him as he opens the book, revealing old black-and-white photos and handwritten field notes, the writing still clear decades later. He says, "My grandfather Enoch was a great geologist, but instead of academia, he worked for the oil companies. That's where I learned to love geology, him bringing back rock samples for me. He traveled all around the world, jungles to deserts. But that rock formation you showed me, it triggered something he showed me years back. Ah, here we go." He traces his finger up and down two photos stuck in glassine pages, side by side. "Here, practically a double to the one on the computer screen, isn't it? See, like I said before, you can see the bedding of sedimentary rock, but the absence of distinct clastic grains means this rock is either a limestone or dolostone. Also, you can see the presence of the distinct chert horizons, which narrows it down considerably."
"Narrows it down to what?"
the former president asks. "Oh, no question," Trent says. "Libya, the Nafusa Mountains."
Chapter 78. Hitchcock, Maine. Samantha Keating wakes up in her motel room, someone firmly knocking at her door. She checks the time, just past 5 a.m. She rolls out of bed, barefoot on the rough-surfaced light green rug, wearing loose shorts and a BU t-shirt, and turns on the nightstand light. It takes three tries before she gets it right because her fingers are shaking, and she knows why. Only one reason somebody's at her door so damn early in the morning. In seconds, she's there, unchaining and unlocking, taking deep breaths, trying to stay calm despite the sudden chill in her hands and feet, thinking of her Mel out there in some wilderness, her remains exposed to the elements and birds and coyotes and... Samantha gets the door open. It's still dark outside. From the utility lights in the motel's small parking lot, she sees Matt standing in front of her. Instantly, there's love and fear and lots of guilt. Guilt from knowing that years back she could have ensured Matt's easy re-election and the safety of their girl, but chose not to do so. Guilt about how she's been coldly ignoring his desperately cheerful video messages from their lakefront home. She leans on the doorframe for support. "Oh, Matt, where?" she asks, voice choked. He takes both of her hands. "Sam," he says, "I think she's still alive." She falls into his arms. A minute later, she's sitting on her still warm bed, and Matt is sitting next to her, arm around her shoulders, his free hand grasping hers. He says, "A forensic scientist came by yesterday, unofficially and on his own. He's well-respected, knows his stuff, and Agent Stahl vouches for him. He's convinced the video of Mel's murder was faked."
"But I saw it. You saw it."
"The blood that struck the camera lens near the end," her husband says. "The professor is convinced it's fake. The way it moved, dripped, it didn't have the consistency of fresh blood. He thinks there's a good chance it wasn't even human blood." Samantha feels as though she's on one of those tilt-a-whirl carnival rides from when she was younger, going in all directions, up and down and sideways, not even sure what is true and secure. This unexpected visit, Matt dropping in here without warning, it seems too good to be true. A dream that she's in the middle of experiencing, a dream where Mel is still alive. "Matt, are you sure? It looks so real." With confidence, he says, "Faraj, Asim al-Ashid's cousin, spent months in Paris studying film and special effects. That's how it could have been faked. And there's another piece of information." Now she's afraid that if she says anything, she'll burst into tears. Samantha just nods. "If the beheading was faked, why not the location?" Matt goes on, still holding her tight. "Asim said he and Mel were still in New Hampshire. I found a geology professor from Dartmouth last night. He said the rock surface in the video isn't from New Hampshire or even New England. The video was recorded in Libya, in the Nafusa Mountains, where Asim is from and where he likes to hide out." "The float plane," Samantha says, finding her voice. "It took her north, to an airport somewhere. That's why there was the delay in the videotape. They had to have enough time to fly her to Libya." Matt says, "Exactly." Samantha now feels incredibly light all over, as if she could float off the bed and gently bump into the ceiling if Matt wasn't holding onto her so tight. "Matt, do you have that forensic professor with you? Or the geologist?"
"No," he says. "It's just Agent Stahl in Washington."
But she stops. She knows what she's feeling, what she's about to say. "Evidence. You need solid evidence before coming up with a theory, especially a theory like this one. So welcome, yet so unsupported." "I want to believe," she thinks. "I have to believe. But I need to see the evidence for myself before I start hoping again." "I need to see the evidence," Matt says quietly. "Sam, you were going to say something?" She squeezes his hand right back. "Trust him. Trust your man." She says, "Yes, this information. Do you think anyone else has it? Somebody from the FBI or Homeland Security?" "No," he says, "not right now." "Good," she says. Matt releases his grip to get a better look at her. "Sam, what did you just say?"
"You heard me," she says, feeling stronger, happier. "What are the chances that if someone in the government found this out, it would remain secret? Somebody might want to leak it to impress their husband or wife, or get a favor from a news reporter. They wouldn't care. It's just another headline, another deposit in somebody's favor bank.
or they would take their time trying to confirm, reconfirm before doing anything. Matt stands up, holding her hands, bending down to kiss her, and then breaking away, his hands still in hers. "Sam, I'm going to get our girl back." "I know you are," she says. "You get Mel, you get her safe, and you bring her home. But you're going to do one more thing." "What's that?" She kisses his hand. "Once you get Mel back, safe and sound, you kill that son of a bitch, Asim."
Chapter 79. Lake Marie, New Hampshire. Secret Service agent David Stahl watches as one of the two Boston whalers owned by Homeland Security motors out to the flat and clear waters of the lake, and he stifles a yawn. He's drunk 3 more cups of coffee than his usual daily ration, but he still feels as though he could close his eyes and sleep until the sun rises the next day. A long, long night and early morning, driving straight through from Enfield to Hitchcock, Maine, and then back again to Lake Marie, traveling mostly on narrow country roads, twice dodging moose rambling out in front of the Suburban. On the way to Maine, Harbor briefed Agent Washington, and now she's part of the rescue mission planning. David is confident that she has Harbor's back. Nice to trust your team. He's still running down a mental checklist for Harbor's mission when he hears steps on the dock. He turns as Agent Brett Payton, his supposed deputy here on the detail, approaches. David has the irrational feeling that if Payton was out as long as he was last night, the guy wouldn't look tired or even have a hair out of place.
"How goes it, Dave?" Payton asks.
"It goes," David says. He wants to get back to his barn office, but Payton gently steps in front of him. Smile still firmly secured, Payton says,
"Odd that during my brief time here, I think I've found the root cause of why this detail failed. Too comfortable, too loose. Like your travels all last night with Harbor. No planning, no logistics, just saddle up and go."
David says, "Harbor was feeling stir-crazy, having been stuck here in the compound since he came back from Virginia. Agent Washington and I took him for a drive. His mood improved. Then he wanted to go see Harp. It's been a while." Payton still has that frozen, know-it-all look on his face, and he says,
"Still, unorthodox."
"You know how it is, Brett," David says. "You need to balance keeping the protectee safe with not keeping him or her stuck in a room covered with bubble wrap. Keeping the protectee both safe and happy. A hell of a job, isn't it? If most of your career had been spent in the field instead of behind a desk chasing down cyber criminals, you might be more aware of that." Peyton's smile fades.
"It's an important job."
"True, but not as important as protecting POTUS, other government officials, and foreign dignitaries," David says. "That and counterfeiting were our original roles, and some fools years back decided it was a good idea to do a power grab, get the Secret Service into areas it had no business being in, like cybercrime, which seems to be the business you love." Peyton steps closer, and now the smile is gone. "It'd be better for you and the agency if you and this entire detail resign. Within the week. I have it on good authority that the director and the Secretary of Homeland Security would look favorably upon it. But nothing in writing, I'm sure."
"Of course not."
"Well, I'll certainly keep that under consideration, Brett. In the meantime, I've got lots of work to do.
Including additional unorthodox trips with Harbor?"
Those words make David feel as though he's just had his feet nailed to the dock. What the hell does Payton know? He keeps his voice controlled.
"Within reason, certainly.
Harbor's not under house arrest. If he wants to leave the compound, we'll make it work."
"Suppose it's another long trip, like last night?"
David says, "Like I said, within reason."
"That's the situation, isn't it?"
Brett goes on.
"You have a protectee who's deep in grief, probably feeling guilt over what happened to his girl, guilt at knowing his actions as POTUS led to her death. It might pressure him to do something unwise, and our job is to keep him safe and keep him grounded, right?"
David knows he's about 30 seconds away from tossing Payton into the lake. Brett lowers his voice,
Resign already. You're too close to Harbor. If he were to do something reckless, you might not want to stop him. David, you'd do him and the agency well by leaving sooner rather than later.
David slowly nods. From your point of view, Brett, I'm sure that makes sense. Leave, wash your hands, put your head down and bail out. But from where I stand, where I'm continuing to stand until told otherwise, leaving is another way of quitting. He walks forward, enjoying jostling Peyton as he passes him on the dock. If you had been in the Marines like me, you would have known I'm not a quitter, David says. And if you haven't figured it out yet, neither is Harbor.
Chapter 80. First Congregational Church of Spencer, Spencer, New Hampshire. It's just past 11 a.m. on a Sunday in this plain, white congregational church that was built when America was still only 13 colonies, and I'm enjoying every minute of being here. I grew up in a small crossroads town in the flat plains of Texas, and its history, Native Americans, first settlers, cotton farms, conflicts here and there, and the joy of Juneteenth in 1865 and additional long years of drought and deprivation, could be written on a pamphlet. In this town, first settled in 1758, the history fills three leather-bound volumes, and a retired history teacher from the local regional high school is hard at work on volume four. One of my quiet hobbies is reading up on the history of my new home and surrounding towns and retaining quirky bits of knowledge, like the fact that in this county, there are five fake underground railroad stations for every real one that helped escaping slaves cross the nearby Canadian border. And why are so many fake? Because it usually adds 10% value to the sale of historic homes. Earlier, the pews were unbolted and stacked in the corner while I worked with other members of the church in this small kitchen in the rear. My specialty is flapjacks, which these stubborn northerners call pancakes, and it's good to be working hard in the small kitchen with laughs and jokes and gentle ribbing as flapjacks, bacon, sausage, scrambled eggs, and French toast get passed out through a rectangular opening where church volunteers pick up the freshly cooked food and bring it out to the guests. The church charges nothing for this Sunday feast, which is run by volunteers, and most of the food is donated, although there's a large glass mason jar at the entrance for contributions. Mostly it's a place to catch up with one's neighbors, pass along the latest family news or gossip, and just maintain that elusive sense of community. As I help wash dishes, I get a warm feeling in knowing that this tradition has been going on for more than two centuries. I grab a plate of flapjacks and bacon, volunteers eat last, and Agent David Stahl steps in and says, "Looks like you worked up quite the appetite, sir." "And I bet you've already eaten," I say. "Good guess, sir," he says. "Here, this way." I follow his lead across the wooden floor, the old planks creaking, and I'm pretty much ignored by the guests finishing up their breakfasts, lingering over cups of coffee and tea. Another reason I like living around here is that in the true Yankee sense, people mostly mind their own damn business. I approach a small folding card table underneath a large black-and-white photo of some stern-looking minister from 1901. Sitting there are two men, early 30s, one with a mustache, the other with a neatly trimmed beard, both wearing jeans and polo shirts. The one with the beard is wearing a plain red polo, and his mustached seatmate is wearing a black one. They nod as I sit down. I say, "Enjoy your meal?" "Pretty damn good," the bearded one says at my left. His companion nods. An older woman volunteer smiles and comes by and drops off coffee in a chipped white mug, and I take a bracing sip. It's made just the way I like, black with two sugars. The bearded man starts. "Mr. President, I dig into my flapjack. "Stop that. From now on, it's Matt, all right?" He knowingly nods. "Absolutely, sir." "Damn it, and cut out the sir crap, too." "Ah," I pause. Then he says, "Habit. Sorry." "Not a problem," I say. "Just as long as your buddy and you have kept other habits up to snuff." His companion says, "You got it. We're ready to go whenever you need us." "Your status?" The bearded man says, "Both of us on 14 days leave, and if that's not enough, we'll figure something out. We're also geared up." I nod, continue eating. The flapjacks are delicious, of course, and despite New Englanders being New Englanders, I love their insistence on using real maple syrup. The first time I ever tasted the real stuff was when I moved up here 18 months ago, and I've never looked back. Which teams are you with? The man on the right says, six. We're both with six. And you know what you volunteered for, right? I say. I'm sure you do, but I want to make sure there's a complete understanding. This is unofficial, off the books, illegal, and even if it's successful, prison time is a real possibility. The seal on the left says, we're all in. His companion says, we want to make it right for what happened to your daughter. My daughter. I smile. Since I've talked to Trask Floyd, the scope of the mission has expanded. It's not just a zap mission. It's also a rescue. That beheading video was faked. I'm pretty sure Mel is being held in the Nafusa Mountains in Libya. I enjoy seeing the shocked looks on both of their faces. There's a myth that SEALs are 6 feet tall with lots of ripped muscles on top of other muscles. The truth is, what counts in SEALs is the muscle between the ears. In Bud's training, it was usually the overbulked and exercised recruits who failed first. The ones who hung tough and kept their smarts about them were the ones who eventually got the tridents. I reach into my coat pocket, pull out a slip of paper, slide it over. A room's been rented at this motel in Kontukuk. I'll see you there at noon tomorrow. Gonna be tricky for you, the seal on the right says. Tricky's gonna be our way of life over the next several days, I say. But before we go on, I'm sorry. I should have asked your names. The one with the mustache says, Alejandro Lopez, bosun's mate first class. I go by Al or Alejandro. All right, I say. And the other seal is smiling widely like he's keeping a wonderful secret. And by God, he is. Chief Nick Zeppos, he says. And Matt, you can just call me Nick. His name. That familiar voice. Me talking to him more than 2 years ago from my chair in the Situation Room. Now you squids body back that son of a bitch for the country, the SEALs, and especially for Boyd Tanner. Chief Zeppos, I say, damn it, you were lead on that mission to nail a seam more than 2 years back. He's still smiling, but it's not a friendly smile. It's the look of a wolf, ready to hunt. That's why I'm here, Matt, he says. This time, we're going to get it done.
Chapter 81 Mary's Diner, Leah, New Hampshire. Secret Service agent Brett Payton is riding in the lead black Chevrolet Suburban as Harbor decides to have breakfast at a local greasy spoon about 20 minutes away from his compound. Another typical outing for a very atypical former president, and Payton wishes the damn man would just stay in his compound and brood, mourn, and play poker. Brett's own favorite card game is cribbage, depending more on smarts than on just damn luck. Instead of going out like this, the pathetic guy seems to need and thrive on mingling with the so-called plain folks in these small northern towns. Agent Kelly Ferguson, a slim black woman, is driving this Suburban, and behind them is the second Suburban, with Harbor in the rear and agents Stahl and Washington riding up front. There was a small crowd gathered by the state police roadblock greeting the two-vehicle motorcade, and Brett wonders if Harbor waved back at them through the tinted glass. And it's odd. Kelly seems to have read his mind. She says, "You think Harbor waved back?" "Who knows?" he answers. "Tarpon wouldn't," she says, using their code name for President Barnes. Too busy reading, plotting against her enemies, or listening to her husband. "But Harbor, he would. He's that kind of guy." Brett laughs. "You've been here less than a month, drinking the Kool-Aid already? He's just a former POTUS, nothing else." Kelly says, "Well, that's your opinion, nothing more. And those folks at that suicide temple in Jonestown didn't drink Kool-Aid. It was Flavor-Aid. Get your facts straight." "Shut up and drive," Brett shoots back, and he's slightly surprised at how angry he's just gotten. The truth is that Agent Stahl and the others on the original detail are getting under his skin. When he was transferred here, Brett expected a group that was shell-shocked about what happened to the president's daughter, nervous about the hammer that was going to soon come down on them. But the detail acted nothing like that. They moved around and did their jobs and responded to Harbor's jokes and gentle teasing as though nothing had happened. It's an open secret that he has been sent here to collect information for the upcoming hearings and disciplinary action, but for the most part, he's been cheerfully ignored by the original detail. And that earlier comment from Stahl at the boat dock about cybercrime also struck home. For most of Brett's career has been with the Secret Service's Criminal Investigative Division in D.C., working on cyber investigations and other financial crimes. A few years back, he was transferred to protective operations as part of his crawl up the career ladder, and although he won't admit it to anyone, he's looking forward to getting out of fieldwork. Mary's Diner comes into view on Route 115 as Agent Ferguson flicks on the Suburban's directional, and Brett notes the battered pickup trucks and old Volvos and Toyotas parked in the dirt lot. Not much chance of any cybercrime happening here, and truth be told, that's why Brett is tired of being in the PPD. The long hours of just standing around. That's it. Just standing around, wasting time. He'd much rather be in a cool and protected office somewhere, 9 to 5 in front of a computer terminal, being a hell of a lot more productive than he feels standing in front of some out-of-the-way diner while the protectee is eating ham and eggs and shaking hands with the locals. The Suburban comes to a halt, and he and Agent Ferguson slide out, joining Agents Washington and Stahl as Harbor exits the Suburban's rear door, looking more relaxed and grungier than usual. Harbor is wearing a worn dark brown leather jacket, Dartmouth ball cap, blue jeans, and black sneakers, and it looks as though he hasn't shaved in 2 or 3 days. Stahl takes lead and goes into the diner, a one-story brick and wood building with a pitched roof abutting a river at the rear, with Harbor right behind him and Washington riding tail. Brett nods to Ferguson and says, "Okay, then," and Ferguson walks around to the rear of the diner while he maintains his post outside the front door. He can't help it. Brett yawns. An early morning mist is hugging the dark green of the forested hills around this part of the town of Leah. There's a gas station and convenience store across the street, a couple of smaller homes down the road, and about 100 feet away, a bigger, sagging, yellow house that's known around here as a colonial. Brett grew up in Phoenix, worked in the Arizona Department of Public Safety before joining the Secret Service, and one big surprise is seeing how old everything around here is. Hell, Phoenix didn't become an official city until 1881 or thereabouts, and folks here don't think it's a big deal to own a house that was built in the 1700s. He yawns again. Brett thinks that one day somebody should write a book called Boredom, a Secret Service Agent's Memoir. From his earpiece, he hears from inside the diner,
"Stahl here with Harbor."
Brett speaks into his wrist, "Roger that." And there are echoing responses from Ferguson and one of the on-duty agents back at the former president's home. "Lake Marie acknowledged," says a woman's voice. More than an hour later, Brett is pacing the dirt lot, no longer bored. What the hell is taking Harbor so long? Over the last hour, there have been quick updates from Stahl, all repeating the same thing.
"Harbor is secure."
But doing what? Working on his third breakfast? Brett brings the wrist microphone to his mouth and says, "Ferguson, is Harbor back there helping to empty the trash? Only thing going on back here is a turf war between chipmunks and squirrels," she replies via his radio earpiece. He says, "Stahl, this is Peyton. What's your status?" An older couple walks out of the diner, the man saying, "Don't know why you have to over-tip all the time, Jenny." No answer. "Stahl, this is Peyton. Reply, please." The older couple climbs into a dark blue Volvo sedan. She starts the engine, and they drive off on the narrow and empty country road. "What the hell?" "Ferguson, this is Peyton," he says, voice tight. "Something's wrong. I'm going in." Ferguson says, See you inside. He slides his light jacket aside, hand on his Sig Sauer P229 semi-automatic pistol, and he quickly enters the diner. Snapshot view. Tables and booths to the left, counter with round stools in front, half or so occupied. Everyone here turning their heads to look at him, and then to see Agent Ferguson come in through the kitchen area from the right. No President Keating, nor Agent Stahl, nor Agent Washington. A bone-thin, white-haired woman wearing black slacks and a pink top comes by, expertly balancing a tray on her left shoulder, and Brett steps in front of her. President Keating, where is he? She shrugs. He went down there a while ago. Where? Brett demands. Went where? She gestures with her free shoulder to the far corner of the diner, where there's a closed wooden door next to towering piles of cardboard boxes, and he gets to the door, throws it open, sees a staircase leading to a cellar. Light switch on. Agent Ferguson is right behind him. Down the worn wooden steps to the cellar, low ceiling. Mr. President? He calls out. Stahl! Washington? There are two freezers, shelves filled with canned goods. Ferguson slides past, and there's a roaring in Brett's ears, hands cold, now holding his Sig Sauer, thinking, an ambush? Another kidnapping? Why no gunshots?
Peyton, over here.
He goes around a set of shelves to an old brick and stone foundation, and there's a heavy wooden door set in the center. Ferguson tugs the door open, steps through, flashlight in hand, lighting up the interior. A brick-lined tunnel going into the darkness. Brett stands next to Ferguson. Holy shit, he says. A woman's voice behind them. Nothing holy about it. And there's a laugh. Brett turns, and the older woman with the black slacks and pink top is there, wrinkled face smiling. He says, what is this? A storage room? Root cellar? A firm shake of the head. Nope. Smuggling tunnel, back during Prohibition. Ferguson says, where does it go? About 100 feet over to the Trainer House. Back in the day, the boats would come down the Trinity River from Ontario with all that fine Canadian whiskey and beer. They'd drop it off at the house, and then it'd get brought over here through that tunnel, back when this place was a roadhouse. Exciting times. Ferguson says, Peyton, we've got to get the word out. Before Brett can reply, the older woman digs into her slacks, pulls out a folded envelope, and says, You, Agent Peyton, Secret Service? He nods. This is for you, then, she says, passing over the envelope. The envelope is buff ivory, professionally made, and in the upper left corner is the seal of the United States, and under that, the words, Office of Matthew Keating. Brett's own name is handwritten in the center. He tears open the envelope, quickly reads the single sheet of paper, knowing with a sharp clarity, like a lightning bolt nearby, that both his career and the former president are gone.
Chapter 82. Autumn Leaves Motel, Contoocook, New Hampshire. The largest room the Autumn Leaves Motel offers is crowded this morning with myself, Secret Service Agent David Stahl, and the two Navy SEALs, Alejandro Lopez and Nick Zeppos, who earlier undid the frame of one of the two beds and put it and the mattress and the box spring up against a wall. Piled in one corner are variously sized duffel bags containing our equipment, and on the thin blue carpet, a large-scale topo map of Libya is spread out. We're drinking coffee from a local Dunkin' as our planning continues. Hard to explain, but I feel pride, hope, and exhilaration being with these fellow warriors, preparing to go into the field one more time. The cliché of Shakespeare's famed Henry V speech before the Battle of Agincourt, we few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother, is a cliché because it's true. These men here, no matter the outcome, will always be my brothers. To the head of my Secret Service detail, I said, David, how long before the Secret Service gets mobilized and starts beating the bushes for me? Never, he says. Even the two SEALs seem to sit up and take notice. Why's that, I ask. David says, once you left Secret Service protection, it became an FBI matter. The same when Mel was kidnapped, the FBI took control. Alejandro smiles. But he hasn't left Secret Service protection. You're still here, eh? David doesn't smile in return. Official protection, not what we've got going on here. Once Matt left, it became the FBI's responsibility. Word probably went right to the top to Director Blair, and they're gearing up right now to start the search. It's going to be one intense effort, sir. I say, but the note I left behind at the diner, won't that buy us some time? David says, doubtful. The FBI can't take that letter at face value. They'll have to assume that this is part of a kidnap plot, maybe a follow-up to Mel's kidnapping, and respond appropriately. Good, I say. Now all three of my fellow brothers in arms are staring at me. Nick says, sir? Good, I repeat. By now, Director Blair has briefed President Barnes. You think she wants word to get out that I've disappeared after the news leaks and columns about their botched response to my daughter's kidnapping? No, they don't want the added humiliation. That's the biggest reason governments keep secrets. Not because they're sensitive, because the secrets are embarrassing. Alejandro says, it'll get out eventually. Sure, I say. In a day or two. And by then, we'll be in North Africa, God willing, and the crick don't rise. And if Agent Washington makes good distance before being picked up. Secret Service Agent Nicole Washington, devoted to her career and to protecting me. A black woman from Anacostia in D.C., and not the part of Anacostia that's being gentrified with cafes and brick sidewalks. When I asked her to do this one task that has a good chance of ruining her life and career, drive on back roads through rural Maine, carrying my iPhone and David's Android and radio gear in case our searchers can track those instruments, she just nodded and said, "It'll be an honor, Mr. President." What did I and the country ever do to deserve such people? I take a sip of strong coffee. Back to the original question, where do we insert in Libya? I can make some calls, get us private transport from one of my deep-pocketed donors, though it might take some time finding a transatlantic jet to get us there. David says, Libyan customs might frown upon letting us in with all that gear we're carrying. I say, then our air transport goes for a private strip. Money gets passed around, the customs folks decide all at once to kneel down and tie their shoes as we depart. But what next? Steal or rent some ground transport and make a high-speed run to the Nafusa Mountains, hoping we get actionable intelligence by the time we arrive? Alejandro shakes his head. Mr. President, Matt. I don't like it. I was there 6 months ago. Libya is damn fragile, especially once you get out of the coast cities like Tripoli or Misrata. There are pretty much only two major highways that run into the interior from the western part of the country, and you stand a good chance of running into armed checkpoints. Depending upon who's getting paid and what day of the week it is, those checkpoints could be regular Libyan army, militia, or tribesmen looking for tribute. Too messy. I'm not. Good point. Plus, I'm sure our Chinese friends are all over the place, still pouring money into their Belt and Road initiative. They see four Americans show up at any airstrip, we'll have a ground asset or drone following us as soon as we leave the runway. Nick leans over the large map, taps a finger, and says, Tunisia. We get to Tunisia at their base at Sfecostino on the coast. They have a unit of the Groupe des Forces Spéciales, their special forces group, based there. Me and a platoon spent 5 months there last year doing training. I like what I'm hearing. Go on, Nick. With some encouragement, I bet we can get them spun up for a training mission. And if it goes cross-border into Libya, well, navigation accidents happen all the time. But that's a closed base. No civilian aircraft allowed. Then we'll get over there on a military flight, I say, staring at the detailed map of Libya while my mind sees a map of New England. Vermont has an Air National Guard unit at Burlington, but only F-35 fighter jets are stationed there. No good. And Maine's Air National Guard base is up in Bangor, and that's at least a four-hour drive away, and gents, we don't have 4 hours. It's going to be Pease, over on the New Hampshire coast in Newington. Less than an hour away if we push it. David says, what's there, Matt? Refueling tankers. Both the KC-135 and the newer KC-46 both have the range to get us there. But getting us on one of those aircraft. I fall silent, knowing that with the right phone calls, I can get the necessary information as to what refueling jets are stationed at Pease. Are any leaving within the next several hours? And oh, by the way, are any of them going to the Mediterranean? And would it be any problem to take along four passengers with enough weaponry to go up against a squad of ISIS fighters? But making phone calls means leaving digital crumbs out there for the FBI or the White House to locate. What to do? What to do? What? A firm knock on the door. We all look in the same direction. The knock comes back harder. I say, if that's the FBI, then I'm seriously impressed. Nick says, hard to believe, sir. We paid for the room in cash with black IDs. There should be no trace that we're here. Another knock, and I say, Dave, answer the damn door. We don't need anybody out in the parking lot reporting a disturbance. Nick, fold up the map. Alejandro says, maybe you should hide out in the bathroom. The suggestion irritates me. I sit in the corner, pull a plain black baseball cap down on my head. I'm not hiding, but Dave, get rid of whoever's out there. Nick quickly folds up the map, and Alejandro pulls a sheet from the disassembled bed, tosses it over the pile of black duffel bags containing our gear. Dave goes to the door, unlocks it, opens it. A slim young woman is there, early 20s, wearing jeans and a black t-shirt with a red anarchy symbol on the front. Her red hair is cut short, and she's wearing plain black-rimmed glasses, and she says, oh, good, you haven't left yet. Dave says, excuse me, what did you just say? And who the hell are you? She ducks down, picks up a computer bag and her own black duffel bag, and comes into the room seemingly without a worry in the world. She spots me, drops her stuff, and nods. Mr. President, she says, Claire Boone, National Security Agency. I was here a couple of weeks ago as part of the response to help find your daughter. And that sure as hell turned into a goat rope of epic proportions, didn't it? Let's do it right this time, okay? I take off my baseball cap, stand up. What do you mean, do it right? She dumps her computer bag onto the remaining bed, unzips it, and takes out a laptop, and then sits down on the bed next to it. We need to get to the med as fast as we can, and I think I've got an asset lined up. The NSA woman powers up her computer and looks around at the four silent men standing in the room. What, you can't speak? You want me to leave? No, I say, stepping toward her and her laptop. I don't want you to leave.